over to chapter 7. Chapter 7 takes place in the first year of Belshazzar. And chapter 8 takes place in the third year of Belshazzar. So if you want to put the events in chronological order, they would be chapter 4, chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 5. So we're jumping to the end right here where Belshazzar meets his demise, but he's going to pop up again in chapter 7 and 8 because they actually took place earlier. Okay, so that's a thought we need to keep in mind. I'm going to share chronology with you. So this is basically the Neo-Babylonian Empire, the kings in this empire. And the first king was Nabopolassar. He was Nebuchadnezzar's father. And then we've got Nebuchadnezzar II. So there was an old Babylonian Empire. What we call the Babylonian Empire is actually the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And Nebuchadnezzar II, he's the one who defeated Jerusalem in 586. But earlier in 605, he took Daniel. In 597, he took Ezekiel. And in 586, he destroyed the city and the temple. His son is Evil Merodach, or Amel Marduk. And Marduk would be one of the major, probably the what would you call the prime deity of Babylon. He reigned for a couple years after his father. And then he was, and actually Evil Merodach is mentioned a couple times. He's mentioned in 2 Kings and in Jeremiah. And he's the one who kind of liked Jehoiachin and let him out of prison. He was assassinated by Nergal-Sharezer, who was his brother-in-law. And then he reigns for a few years, and then he's succeeded by his son, Labashai Marduk. And then Nabonidus comes along and assassinates him. Now, if you look, there's really, once Nebuchadnezzar's gone, from 562 to 539, very short period of time. And they went through 5 kings, and then the empire fell. The son, and here's where how you translate the Hebrew word son and father comes into play, because both of those words don't necessarily mean my dad or my child. So the Hebrew word father is very often used to reference a forefather, and it can go back generations. Same thing with the Hebrew word son. It can represent any male descendant of mine, even generations from me. So there's lots of debate as to whose father Belshazzar was. Most people think he was the actual son of Nabonidus. Well, then who's his mother? And here's where it gets kind of interesting. Some people think that Nebuchadnezzar's daughter married Nabonidus and had Belshazzar, which would make Belshazzar Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. Other people think that Nabonidus married Nebuchadnezzar's widow and had Belshazzar. And others think Nabonidus married whoever and had Belshazzar. And the only reason Nebuchadnezzar is referred to as father and Nebuchadnezzar or Belshazzar his son is because he's in that line. And so, you know, it just depends on what commentary you're looking at, because I've got a bunch of them and they all say different things. But at the time, if you look at these dates, so for example, this date here overlaps with Belshazzar. So Nabonidus began reigning in 556. His son began co-reigning with him 3 years later, and they both reigned until the empire fell in 539. And Daniel actually brings that point up in chapter 5, and I'll point that out to you. So at the time, what was going on here, and I'm going to bring up a new diagram. So at the time, Babylon was being surrounded by the Medo-Persian army. And here's just a kind of a sketch of Babylon. What's interesting is that the Euphrates River ran through the city, and there was a canal around it, actually several canals around it. And then you've got this outer wall that goes around. So the Euphrates River ran through Babylon. And so at this point in history, Babylon is surrounded by the Medo-Persian army. The city's in lockdown. They had all the food and the water they needed. I mean, they could have survived probably for a few years. They had that many supplies. And eventually they were hoping that the Medes and the Persians would just get bored and give up. Well, the Medes and the Persians had other plans. And what they did is they diverted the Euphrates River. And so now the Euphrates River going through is basically a dry riverbed. And because it's going underneath the walls, they could send somebody under the wall to go into the city and unlock the gates. So Belshazzar, he wasn't the brightest bulb in the box. And he was thinking, well, no one's going to ever get into Babylon. We're secure. We've got these massive walls. This is a fortress. Yeah, let's throw a party. So that's the background behind this chapter. Does anybody need to see those dates, that timeline again? Because if they do, I can certainly put those back. I can't tell anyway. All right, so chapter five, Belshazzar the king held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he's drinking wine in the presence of 1,000. So his city's being surrounded by the enemy, and he's throwing a party because he doesn't believe for a moment that Babylon would ever get defeated. Now, his father, Nabonidus, he was kind of sent away. And the reason he was sent away is because Nabonidus was a worshiper of the moon god. Well, the moon god was not the primary deity of Babylon. Marduk was. And so the priests of Marduk were afraid that Nabonidus might kind of unthrone Marduk and set up his own deity. So they sent him away. And so now his son is co-ruling with him, but he's all by himself in Babylon. Dad's off someplace else doing whatever. So Belshazzar is throwing this giant feast, 1,000 of his nobles. He tasted the wine, must have been really good wine, because he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels, which Nebuchadnezzar, his forefather, that's how that word should be translated. He wasn't, probably wasn't his direct father. Maybe a grandfather, maybe along that line, but forefather. So he knows all about what Nebuchadnezzar had done in defeating the Babylonian, or in defeating the Jews in 586, all of the treasures that he brought. And he decides, why don't we bring some of the gold and the silver vessels out of the temple that was in Jerusalem, and we can drink from those. The king, his nobles, his wives, his concubines. So they brought the gold vessels that were taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem. And the king and his nobles, his wives, his concubines, they drank from them. And they praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So in his mind, using the articles of a defeated god, at least that's what he thought. He thought that Nebuchadnezzar had defeated the god of the Jews, and so we're going to use these articles to toast our gods because they were the victors. It's very similar to what the Philistines did with the ark when they captured the ark in the time of Eli. They put it in the temple of Dagon, thinking, well, we're going to make the ark bow before our God. And that didn't work out too well. Exactly what's going on here. He's using these articles of what he thought was a defeated God to praise his gods that he thought were victors. Well, suddenly, the fingers of a man's hand emerge. And here's a little picture of that. Now you can't really see the hand, but the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. And now he's freaking out. His face grew pale. His thoughts alarmed him. His hip joints went slack. His knees began knocking. So he's terrified. And he sees this hand and it's writing Aramaic on the wall. And he doesn't understand what's going on. So the king, he called aloud, screaming, to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, the diviners. Anybody who could somehow read the inscription and interpret it. So he spoke to the wise man. Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold and around his neck and authority as third ruler in the kingdom. So remember, his father, Nabonidus, was the primary ruler, but because he, the priests of Marduk, didn't like the god he worshipped, they kind of pushed him off to the side and sent him off to another part of Babylon. Belshazzar was the second ruler, and he's offering anyone who can read the inscription and interpret it the privilege of being the third ruler. So all the wise men came in. They couldn't read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. I find it kind of odd that they couldn't read the inscription, because it's written in Aramaic. So they should have been able to read it. But for whatever reason, they couldn't read it, and they certainly couldn't interpret it. And so now Belshazzar is even more alarmed, and his face grew even paler, and his nobles are perplexed. Here's this writing on the wall, and nobody can read it, and no one can interpret it, and the king is going crazy. Well, then the queen entered the banquet hall. We're not sure who this woman is. I find it unlikely that she's actually his wife. She may be the queen mother, or even a widow, one of the widow of Nebuchadnezzar. But anyway, she comes in, and she enters the banquet hall because words spread really fast. And she spoke and said, "O king, live forever. Don't let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods." And remember how Nebuchadnezzar referred to Daniel at the very beginning? You know, there's a spirit of the holy gods in you. Well, these people obviously didn't learn the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar learned in the last chapter, that there's not holy gods, there's the holy God. "There's a man in your kingdom, and in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him." So when he interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2, when he interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 4, word gets out, there's a guy who can interpret these things. "And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, the conjurers, the Chaldeans, the diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. So let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation." Now, by the time this happens, so from 605 to 539 is 65 years. Daniel was probably maybe 20 when he was taken. So Daniel's 85 years old. And Daniel's the kind of guy, he's not going to take guff from anybody, especially this Yahoo. So Daniel's brought in out of retirement. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel that was one of the exiles from Judah whom my father, the king, brought from Judah? I've heard about you, that a spirit of the gods is in you, and illumination, insight, extraordinary wisdom are found in you. And just now, the wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me that they might read this inscription," and he kind of points to the wall and make its interpretation known, but they couldn't declare the interpretation of the message. They may have been able to read the words, but they didn't understand it. "And I personally have heard about you that you're able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems." Yeah, he just now heard about it. He probably didn't have a clue who Daniel was before this. "So if you're able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known, I'll clothe you with purple and put a necklace of gold around your neck, and you'll have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom." Daniel's not impressed. So he says to the king, "Yeah, keep your gifts for yourself. Or give your words to someone else. You're not impressing me." Daniel probably thought this guy was an idiot, because Daniel knows the city's surrounded by the Medo-Persians. Daniel knows from Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2 with the statue, the next empire is the Medo-Persian Empire, and they're right outside the gates. And he knows from his vision in chapter 7, which actually took place before this event, that the Medo-Persian is the next empire. So Daniel's already had two visions, the vision that God gave him to interpret the dream in chapter 2 and the vision that God gave him of the beasts in chapter 7. And both of those visions detail the next empire is the Medo-Persians. And they're right outside the gate. So Daniel thinks this guy is an idiot for toasting his gods, for throwing a party for 1,000 of his nobles, when the enemy's outside the gate and his kingdom is going to fall. So he's saying, you know, I'm not really impressed with your gift, because in a matter of a few hours, you're not going to be around to give them to me. You're going to be dead, and your empire is going to be over. So there's not going to be a third ruler in your kingdom. You're not going to have any necklace of gold to give me. You're done tonight. So yeah, I'm not really impressed. So however, I will read the inscription, and I will make the interpretation known to you. So, O king, and this is where he reminds Belshazzar of what happened with Nebuchadnezzar earlier on in the last chapter. So he says, O king, the Most High God, and here he's kind of slamming this notion, he's toasting the gods, thinking that their gods had given them the victory over the God of the Jews, and this notion that a spirit of the holy gods is in you. He's saying, the Most High God, the one true God, granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your forefather. And because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. So everybody was terrified of Nebuchadnezzar. Whomever he wished, he killed. He tried to do that with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Whomever he wished, he spared alive. Whomever he wished, he elevated. Whomever he wished, he humbled. He could do whatever he wanted. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him. So he's reminding him, this is what happens when you get haughty. He was driven away from mankind. His heart was made like that of beasts. His dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and he sets over it whomever he wishes. So he's reminding Belshazzar, you're only on the throne because God let you be on the throne. He's the Most High God. There aren't your little deities that you're praising. They're not gods. And this notion that I somehow have a spirit of the gods is not true. I have the spirit of the living God, the Most High God, but not your little deities, your little gods. Remember, God puts you on the throne. Yet you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. So there wasn't much time between Belshazzar would have known about this because he was alive when Nebuchadnezzar was still king. So he would have known these things. And yet he refuses to humble his heart. And then he says, you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. They've brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines have been drinking wine from them, and you've praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and wood, iron and wood and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand. So you may be a worshiper of Marduk, but when was the last time Marduk ever spoke to you? When was the last time Marduk ever looked at you? When was the last time Marduk ever heard your prayer? It didn't happen. But the God in whose hand are your life breath and all your ways, you've not glorified. So Daniel's not afraid of this guy. He's letting this guy have it. Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. Because of what you've done, because you have refused to humble your heart, knowing everything that God did with Nebuchadnezzar, because you have refused to acknowledge that he's the one who put you on the throne, because you have toasted your blind, deaf, mute gods rather than the God in whose hand is your life breath, he sent this hand. And it's written on the wall. And here's what it says. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. And so Belshazzar is waiting. Okay, what does it mean? Well, this is the interpretation of the message. Mene, God has numbered. Mene means numbered. And so he's saying God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Because you didn't listen to what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, because you refused to acknowledge the one true God, your kingdom is done. And he repeats it twice for emphasis. Tekel means weighed. And so he says, you've been weighed on the scales and you've been found deficient. God has a standard. And so this is a balance scale, and God's standard here, and you're put on the scale. You don't even balance it out. You don't even come close. You're so deficient in everything, you're done. And Peres, upharsin, that's where pharsin is the plural of Peres, means divided. So your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. Now, probably as soon as he heard that, he's thinking to himself, what? You mean those guys that have been surrounding the city? My kingdom's going to be divvied up between them? So he's kind of shocked. Should have taken it more seriously. So Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple, put a necklace of gold around his neck, issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. And he's going to be the third rule for, oh, I don't know, all of 20 minutes. That night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. I'm going to bring up another Whoops. Where did it go? So Belshazzar is slain, and then 539 BC, the empire goes to the Medes and the Persians. And Darius the Mede, so verse 30 is the downfall of the Babylonian Empire. It didn't even let the Neo-Babylonian Empire. It really didn't even last, not even 100 years. So in 626 is when the Neo-Babylonian Empire began. 539, it ends. So it's not even 100 years old. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. Now, Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian co-rule together. So Cyrus is king of Persia already, and he joins forces in 539 with Darius the Mede to become king of the Medo-Persians. And you're going to see a couple of instances of Cyrus. Darius, you're going to see Darius in chapter 6. You're going to see Darius in chapter 9. And then you're going to see Cyrus, chapter 10. Darius is going to come back in chapter 11. So Daniel's prophecies from here on out, they're not in chronological order. I don't know why, but for whatever reason, when he put them all together, he probably put them on scraps of paper and then just stuck them together. Here you go. This is it. But one of the things I want you to note about Darius, in Daniel, it's always, even though it's not stated, this is always Darius the Mede. So in chapter 6, it simply says Darius, but it's Darius the Mede. You've got to keep that in mind, because as you go on in Persian history, there's a Darius the First, and you're going to see him in Ezra and Ezra, and he's just called Darius. So the Darius in Daniel is always Darius the Mede. The Darius in Ezra is Darius the First Hystaspes. He's just called Darius. All right. And then there's going to be later on in history a Darius the Second and a Darius the Third, but you're not going to find them in the Bible. You are going to find just the two Dariuses, Darius the Mede in Daniel, and Darius the First, he's just called Darius in Ezra. So when you come across Darius, remember what book you're in, because they're two totally different guys. Right? So Darius the Mede is going to reign from 539 to 522. And then there's going to be some other kings after Cyrus, and they're going to have very brief reigns. And then 3 years later, another Darius, the guy in Ezra, is going to come into play. Okay. Now, the thing to understand now with the chronology is, now that the Medo-Persian Empire is in play, Cyrus is now king, as well as Darius. Cyrus is the guy in Isaiah 44 and 45 that God calls my shepherd. He calls him my anointed, which is the Hebrew word Messiah. He says to Isaiah that Cyrus is going to rebuild the temple, which kind of confused Isaiah, because when Isaiah wrote that, the temple was still standing. Jerusalem was still standing. And so God is telling Isaiah in Isaiah 44 and Isaiah 45, Cyrus is going to, you know, issue the decree, and the temple's going to be rebuilt, and Jerusalem's going to be rebuilt, and it's going to be re-inhabited. And Isaiah's thinking to himself, what do you mean rebuilt? It's still here. What do you mean re-inhabited? Everybody's still here. So Isaiah's actually prophesying in advance of all of this. Cyrus is also the guy, if you jump over to Ezra chapter 1, he's the one. So in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that's the year that Belshazzar died, was killed. So Ezra chapter 1 goes along with Daniel chapter 5. When Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian conquered Babylon and killed Belshazzar, that year Cyrus issues the decree to send the Jews back. And so the Jews go back under Zerubbabel. If you look over at Daniel chapter 9, in the first year of Darius, so again, this takes place in the same year that Belshazzar is killed, in the same year that Cyrus sends the Jews back, the events of Daniel chapter 9 happen. And one of the things that Daniel chapter 9 mentions, Daniel in verse 2, in the first year of Darius, he's reading the prophet Isaiah. And he comes across several passages that talk about the 70-year desolation of Jerusalem. And he gets out his little calculator and he figures out, hey, that's up. The time's over. And that's exactly the point Ezra makes in Ezra chapter 1. He says, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, in that first year, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus to send the Jews back. So all of those events take place right after Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian kill Belshazzar and defeat the Babylonians. Now the Jews get to go back. So, any questions?
Hey, Jeff, how did Belshazzar get killed? Is it just the Medes and the Persians overtaking the kingdom? I mean, he died that same night?
He died that same night. They got under the wall of the sea after they diverted the Euphrates. They got underneath the wall, and one of the first places they went was to the palace and killed him and probably all of his nobles and his wives and his concubines. And then they, once the king is gone, and remember, Nabonidus, he's nowhere to be found. Nabonidus is off in some distant land doing whatever, you know, he's doing, and probably gets word, oh, there's no more Babylon anymore. I guess I'm not king. We don't know what happened to Nabonidus after that. But yeah, Belshazzar, he gets assassinated by Darius or Cyrus or maybe even one of the soldiers.
Dave Brock has a question.
Yes, Jeff. I've heard that the Medes were first in control and then the Persians, but that apparently is not true. They ruled at the same time?
Yes. Well, the Medes, the Medes were an empire before the Persians. And then the Persians became an empire. And the Persians were actually had a smaller territory. but they were more formidable. And so they made a treaty together and became the Medo-Persian Empire. But the Medes were first, then the Persians, and then they co-ruled together.
Where was Media located in comparison with Persia or Iran as we know it today?
I've got a map of that. Let me, I'll show you. Yeah, it looks. Okay. All right, so let me share this. So Media was this region in here. So here's Babylon in there. Media was actually, you know, I can't draw a picture, but this is Media here, and they would have gone all the way up into here. So Persia, so this would be Iran here. Persia would have been the southern regions of Iran. Okay. And Media would have been the northern regions.
Thank you.
And then so this entire blue area became the Medo-Persian Empire.
And it was all conquered by Alexander the Great then up to the Indus Valley, which is on the very right.
Yes, it was all conquered by Alexander the Great. And I'll show you that. So Alexander's empire was basically, yeah, this region here. So pretty much everything that the Medo-Persians conquered, Alexander conquered.
I see.
But the Medo-Persians didn't go as far west as they wanted. They went far enough west to harass the Greeks, which was a fatal mistake.
Yes. They pushed that in Greece.
Yep.
So is the city of Babylon still in existence, or is it flattened completely?
Well, the ruins are there, but that's about it.
We were talking about gardens. Are the gardens still there?
Nope, the gardens aren't there.
How far is it from Baghdad?
I have no idea. I don't think it's very far. My maps are showing the ancient history, but I don't think from Baghdad to Babylon is that far.
So let's see, when does Babylon reappear in scripture in the New Testament? Is it only in Revelation, or is it?
Yeah, well, Revelation 17 and 18, you've got two different aspects of Babylon. Chapter 17 looks at the religious aspect of Babylon as the harlot. And then chapter 18 looks at the political economic aspect of Babylon.
Dave, did you have your hand up? Did you want to say something?
Just one question. Why was it not the Medo-Persian Empire all the way through, you know, those years? Did Persia turn on Media and conquer them?
I don't know the answer to that. My guess is because the Persians were certainly stronger, they just absorbed that empire and took over the name.
Thank you.
When are we going to show the pictures?
Yes, I want to see pictures of the handwriting on the wall.
Let me show you a picture.
All right, Victoria's got one. So let's see if we can show this.
Oh, okay, cool.
Boy, that's
wow, nice.
Is there a second part, Victoria?
No second part.
Okay.
Anyone else? Oh, okay. Caden or
oh, this is Devin.
Got one. Let me spotlight Devin. Him. All right, there we go.
Oh, you got the hand. Oh,
look at that hand.
I didn't really get to finish it.
Yes, you did. That's good. Oh,
looks good. Looks really good.
Yep, looks nice.
Put a date on it.
Put it on the refrigerator.
The hand looks like the Horicon Bank logo, actually.
It does. Yeah. Book up your own.
Very good.
Any other kids out there with pictures? Love day?
Love day.
Oh, okay, let me switch it over here. Low bandwidth. All right, there we go.
Oh, and look at the hand down there. Whose is that, Lucy's?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, look at that.
Lucy's, that. This is mine.
Lucy, come show you your work.
Nice job, kids.
So now your next assignment. Your next assignment is chapter 6 with the Lion's Den.
Okay, right. Jonathan's drawing.
Oh, where's Jonathan's?
There we go.
Okay, wow. Nice.
And this is Jacob's.
Pretty cool.
Look like an alien.
Yep. Nice. Very nice.
That's written in Malayalam.
I think so, yeah.
So next time you have to draw pictures of Daniel in the lion's den.
Ooh.
And remember, he doesn't get eaten.
With teeth.
Yes. A quick one. Here's Marissa's last one.
Oh, really?
Not mine.
Can you see that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good, Marissa.
Is that a pencil?
Tilted.
Pencil, over. Yeah. Number 2 pencil.
Okay, the translator can't handle that one, Caden. Or Devin, I mean. Well, thank you very much, Jeff.
I had one other comment. Quickly, I just tried to come up with a quick list of parties that didn't go well for somebody in the Bible. So you had it up on the screen there momentarily. Esther, in the beginning of Esther, Queen Vashti, that party didn't go well for her. Later on in Esther, the party didn't go well for Haman.
Yeah.
Let's see. Herod and Herodias, John the Baptist was beheaded after that party. Absalom kind of threw a party to get rid of Amnon. Ahab and Jezebel got rid of Naboth at a party. And then Samson's wedding party didn't go well for his supposed friends. So those are some of the parties I thought of.
Goes right up there with that joke about the Soviet Union. In the U.S., people go looking for the party. In the Soviet Union, old Soviet Union, the party goes looking for you.
That one about Boris Johnson. Yeah. Well, could we list some of the prayer requests? As you think about that, we've got coming up to, is it 8 o'clock? And here are the activities of the week, just to review them. Tomorrow morning, the ladies at 9 o'clock with Carmen. Friday night, kids club. Yes, no? Ray? Kids club.
We've moved it to Saturday now.
Oh, yeah.
Saturday at 10:30.
10:30. Good. Thank you for doing that. So it's just your study at 8 o'clock, right?
8:30, just our study with Jeff.
8:30.
And 9:30 for Carmen's on Thursday morning.
9:30, sorry. Mm-hmm. And then on Sunday, Ray will be preaching. Thank you for that, Ray.
No problem.
TOSA Teens possibly on Monday night. We'll see. And then elders will be meeting also on Monday night. Zoom in if you have some questions or concerns. Zoom in. And then the cottage meeting again on Tuesday, all being well, at 7 o'clock. Next Wednesday, Jeff on Daniel 6 with the Lions. Yeah. See how their draft picks did. Prayer requests. Please continue to pray for our widows, recent widows, Ruth Avers,